This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The world is nearing the 550,000 death toll as a result of COVID-19. More than 132,000 of those deaths are in the U.S. Brazil has more than 68,000, while the United Kingdom has more than 44,000. The number of infections globally just hit the 12 million mark and continues to climb beyond that. The U.S. and Brazil together make up more than a third of that, with the U.S. at more than 3 million and Brazil more than 1.7 million. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador lavished praise on President Donald Trump at their first meeting Wednesday, saying the U.S. leader treated Mexico with respect despite his history of threatening tariffs and insulting Mexicans. The leftist Mexican leader made his first foreign trip as president to the White House, where he and Mr. Trump accentuated the positive in their public remarks while largely glossing over their differences on business, illegal drugs, and migration. The White House said the Mexican delegation, including López Obrador, were tested for the coronavirus before they met with Mr. Trump. Mindful of the pandemic, which is still surging in Mexico and the U.S., the men did not shake hands when Mr. Trump greeted López Obrador. On his arrival, neither of the men wore masks. Australia's second most populous city began a six-week lockdown on Thursday following a spike in new coronavirus cases, as states around the country tighten internal borders to prevent a second wave sweeping the country. Australia has avoided the high casualty numbers of other countries to the COVID-19 pandemic, but an outbreak in Melbourne prompted the state of Victoria to impose self-isolate orders for the city's estimated 5 million people. This is VOA News. After months of touting an unproven anti-malarial drug as a treatment for the new coronavirus, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is turning himself into a test case, lie before millions of people as he swallowed hydroxychloroquine pills on social media and encouraged others to do the same. He said this week that he tested positive for the virus but already felt better thanks to the hydroxychloroquine. Hours later, he shared a video of himself gulping down what he said was a third dose. A string of studies in Britain and the United States, as well as by the World Health Organization, have found that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are ineffective against COVID-19 and sometimes deadly because of their adverse side effects on the heart. Several studies were canceled early because of those adverse side effects. The president, Jair Bolsonaro, vetoed provisions of a law that obligated the federal government to provide drinking water, disinfectants, and a guarantee of hospital beds to indigenous communities during the COVID-19 pandemic. The president's office said those provisions in the law approved by Congress were against the public interest and unconstitutional by creating expenses for the federal government without new sources of revenue to cover them. The humanitarian group Oxfam says the coronavirus has worsened the hunger crisis in the world's poorest corners and warns that up to 12,000 people could die each day from hunger linked to the social and economic impacts of the pandemic. The group's report Thursday says that mass unemployment, disruption of food production, and declining aid as a result of the pandemic could push an estimated 122 million people to the brink of starvation this year. The charity's chief executive warns that the knock-on impacts of COVID-19 are far more widespread than the virus itself, affecting many in middle-income countries like India, South Africa, and Brazil. The Trump administration has proposed empowering border authorities to deny asylum to people from countries with widespread communicable diseases. The announcement is the latest in a string of regulations before the November elections to dramatically raise the bar on who qualifies for humanitarian protections. The Homeland Security and Justice Department say denying asylum to people from high-risk countries would combat disease in the United States. In a Russian bid to get the United Nations to reduce cross-border humanitarian aid to war-torn Syria, was voted down by the Security Council Wednesday. Russia needed 9 votes and no veto from a permanent member of the council to get its resolution passed, but received only 4 votes. The president of the council said that 7 countries voted against it and 4 abstained. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ivory Coast this morning, the sudden death of Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly.
Even though I did not share his political views, I believe that it is a sad news because he's a human being and he represented the country.
A former Tanzanian foreign minister says he will challenge President John Magufuli in the October election. Uganda's Electoral Commission goes to court against prisoners in diaspora voting. Water crisis is worsening in Zimbabwe's second largest city of Bulawayo. And Kenya and the United States have begun trade talks.
We estimate that if we can only capture 5% of the U.S. market for these products, we could increase our export revenue by more than 2 trillion.
And Ghanaians turn to online exercising during coronavirus. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ivory Coast are mourning the sudden death yesterday of Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly. He was 61. Coulibaly was also the presidential candidate for the ruling Rally of Republicans Party in this year's October presidential election to succeed President Alassane Ouattara. President Ouattara described the late Coulibaly as a model of youth, an example of skill, hard work, and selflessness. Nyeka Ngoke is assistant professor of history and Pan-Africana studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. He is also an Ivorian. He says Coulibaly's unexpected demise could reignite the power struggle in the ruling coalition between Northerners and Southerners.
Even though I did not share his political views, I believe that it is a sad news because he's a human being and he represented the country. But at the same time, we can see that the prospect look catastrophic, you know, for Mr. Ouattara's government coalition.
This is the time of the coronavirus. And what we understand is that on Wednesday, Mr. Coulibaly attended a cabinet meeting. So what happened?
The guy had heart surgery. We heard about that in the past. When he went to France, he was there for 2 good months. We heard that he had another heart surgery there. And then all the news that we heard, the doctors told him that he should renounce, you know, to do politics. But he still wanted to become president of the country. As if, you know, he was like in a good shape. But we knew that it was not the reality. So all the people who are observing politics in Ivory Coast were somehow expecting that. It is very sad.
Now, politically, Cote d'Ivoire is supposed to be going to presidential election in October this year. What does this mean for the ruling party?
It is a catastrophe for the ruling party. We knew that Coulibaly was not feeling well. He had several heart failures, but for some reason, he was the choice of Mr. Ouattara, maybe the most loyal of all the people around him. And then the election is in October, in less than 4 months. Now that Coulibaly is gone, we don't know what will happen in the Ouattara's coalition because the Minister of Defense, Ahmed Bakayoko, wants to run for president on behalf of Mr. Ouattara's party. And then Soro Guillaume, the former Speaker of the House, who decided, you know, to oppose Mr. Ouattara openly, now is in exile because, you know, he was condemned by Ouattara's justice system. And then the Speaker of the House does not feel well, and then he does not have the charisma and maybe the, you know, the passion to be the leader of Mr. Ouattara's party. There is a gentleman there called Patrick Ashi. He could become the prime minister of Mr. Ouattara, but he is from the south. And then we know that Mr. Ouattara, all the people I just mentioned, Ouattara, Gon Coulibaly, Ahmed Bakayoko, Soro Guillaume, and many others, they came together to pull together a rebellion for them to conquer state power in order to protect and preserve the privileges of the northerners in the country. Because when people talk about Ivory Coast and they think it was just Ivoirité, you know, there were two dissenting ideologies which were in the central part of the tragedy of the nation. Ivoirité on one side, on the other side, we have the charter of the Northerners. And then Mr. Ouattara today has been putting almost everywhere, like in the most important position of the country, the northerners in Ivory Coast. Now, if Patrick Achi were to become the choice of Mr. Ouattara's coalition, it looks like a matter of last resort, because the northerners are anxious. They have the feeling that, you know, the power is like imploding. And then if they have to choose somebody from the south, they are not sure that that person, Patrick Achi, is going to preserve the interest the way a northerner will do.
Could President Ouattara come back to power, or constitutionally it would be impossible for him to do that?
He says that he can run based on the new constitution. But at the same time, those who put the constitution together in 2016 said that he could not run for president. So that's a huge debate.
Nyeka Ngoke is Assistant Professor of History and Pan-Africana Studies at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Kenya and the United States have begun talks that could eventually lead to free trade between the two nations, one that Kenya hopes would help transform its economy. Speaking in Nairobi Wednesday, Kenya's Trade Cabinet Secretary Betty Maina said a bilateral trade agreement is key in securing trade and investment relations ahead of the coming lapse of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, also known as AGOA, in 2025. Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The 2 weeks talk will begin today, Thursday, and Kenya hopes to conclude the deal within 12 months. In a letter sent out to Kenya on Tuesday, signed by non-governmental organizations, as well as the trade and rights groups across the continent, warned that the deal would cripple Kenya's agriculture and manufacturing sectors that will destabilize efforts to increase intra-regional trade. Kenya's Trade Cabinet Secretary Betty Maina said that the agreement is critical at the moment ahead of the lapse of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, in 2025.
Kenya and the United States of America have today formally entered into negotiations that will culminate in a historic free trade agreement, which will allow duty-free access for Kenya into the U.S. market. The success of the negotiations is particularly critical because of the need to secure trade and investment relations between the two countries ahead of the anticipated lapse of the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act on 30th September 2025.
Critics argue that post-AGOA future needs to be discussed by African countries, and that one country concluding agreement may result to wide range of consequences. Mrs. Maina, however, said that with the trade agreement, Kenya is geared towards increasing its export revenue.
The agreement will provide a predictable framework for investment and trade between the two countries. The ministry has reviewed products that we can promote to the U.S. market, and such products include textiles and apparel, tea, coffee, fish, and fish products, among others. We estimate that if we can only capture 5% of the U.S. market for these products, we could increase our export revenue by more than 2 trillion shillings.
Kenya will be the first sub-Saharan African country to enter into free trade agreement with the United States. U.S. Ambassador to Kenya Kyle McCutter said that the agreement will make Kenya more competitive and economically stronger in the region.
Kenyan and American businesses will benefit from increased access to each other's markets, and consumers will enjoy expanded choice, lower prices, and higher quality in the marketplace. Through a new free trade agreement, Kenya will preserve and expand the access of the United States markets it now has under AGOA. We're going beyond AGOA. We are treating Kenya as an equal, which you are. That does not mean there are not challenges Kenya must rise to meet to take your seat as a rightful economic leader in the region.
More than 70% of Kenya's exports are duty-free under AGOA. The plans to begin talks on the bilateral trade agreement were announced after Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta visited the United States in February this year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Uganda's Electoral Commission has petitioned the High Court against a ruling compelling the commission to allow prisoners and Ugandans abroad to vote. Eric Sabiti, the Electoral Commission lawyer, says the Electoral Commission doesn't have enough resources, including time and money, to include those categories of Ugandans in the forthcoming elections. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi reports from Kampala.
Eric Sabiti, the Uganda Electoral Commission lawyer, says the court ruling came a bit too late for the 2020-2021 general elections.
This ruling came at a time when we are almost at the end tail of the electoral process. Registration of voters is done, the update of register of voters is done, the display is done. What is left in the electoral process is nomination, campaigns, and subsequent reporting. For it to include the two categories would mean to reopen the electoral process. I'll give you an example of people in prisons. A number of them are on remand, but by the time of polling, some of them could be discharged from prison.
Saviti also says the Electoral Commission does not have officials to conduct elections for Ugandans living abroad.
We are saying, court, please give us more time. Let us move relevant stakeholders, that including the Attorney General, to move the relevant bill, relevant law, that can help us easily facilitate the voting or the citizens exercising their rights under the Article 59.
Human rights lawyer Stephen Kalali, who petitioned the court to instruct the Electoral Commission to allow prisoners and Ugandans living abroad to vote, says the Electoral Commission arguments are simply devoid of merit.
When you look at their pleadings, they have failed in court. They have not even attached any evidence to show that they have applied to Parliament for a supplementary budget and the Parliament has denied.
Last month, the High Court ruling directed Uganda's Electoral Commission to ensure that all Ugandan citizens of 18 years and above register and exercise their right to vote as per Ugandan laws. Kalali says the Electoral Commission's petition is not in good faith. He says Uganda can copy from other African countries where citizens living abroad exercise their right to vote.
In South Africa, the first petition that was filed around March, and the voting was in June. The court gave its ruling in April, and they managed to handle that just like it was in Kenya and in Nigeria. We don't need much officials. The issue is about declaring our embassies in these foreign countries to be polling centers or stations for purposes of what? The elections.
The court has fixed the hearing of the Electoral Commission's application on Monday, July 13th. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 9th. Former Tanzania Foreign Minister Bernard Membe says he will challenge President John Magufuli in this year's October presidential election. Membe was expelled from the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM, party over what the party called indisciplined and unethical conduct. But Membe says he was expelled after expressing his intention to challenge President Magufuli. Yesterday, Wednesday, Membe and his wife returned their CCM membership cards. Membe tells VOA he will join the opposition Alliance for Change and Transparency ACT party.
Yes, I have the full intention of running for president in this season because I am mandated by the Constitution. And every corner I go around the country, all phones and everybody wants me to challenge the incumbent.
So this week you return your membership card for the ruling CCM party. Does that mean you are no longer a member of the party or you are a member of the party?
I'm no longer a member of the party. If you may recall, if you were following up developments in this country, on the 28th of February this year, the party dismissed me from the party. I was dismissed on allegations that I was intending to challenge the president, and the challenging the president during the elections was seen as a crime. And so what I did was to surrender my party membership and then join the opposition where I would be free to challenge the current and the sitting president.
So you joined the opposition. On which party's ticket do you intend to run?
I'll be running through the ACT party. I'll be joining this week, if I can qualify.
Oh, that's the party of Mr. Kabwe?
Yes.
So you will be challenging President Magufuli?
Absolutely.
Does that mean that you don't think he deserves to be re-elected?
Look, deserving to be re-elected, it's like the United States. You go through the primaries. That is where the incumbent tests himself, and then he is challenged by the opposition. So if he deserves to be re-elected, let him measure himself against me.
You were stripped of your party membership, as you were saying earlier this year, so for what the party called indiscipline and unethical conduct. What exactly do you think they were talking about?
You know, they were talking about two things. One, that I was planning to run for the presidency, and that I was doing secret campaigns to run for the president, something that they failed because I did not do that. That's one. But number two, my phone was hacked by the government, and then they said I was talking something to say that the ruling party was being split apart. And the argument was hacking somebody's phone is a crime according to our constitution.
I'm sure you have been following developments in Malawi, where the opposition there came together and defeated the incumbent President Mutharika. I know this is the primary season in Tanzania. In my discussion the other day with Mr. Kabwe, he indicated that perhaps his party might be looking or is looking into the possibility of joining other opposition parties for some kind of alliance. Is that something you'll be in favor of?
Sure. What Mr. Kabwe told you is perfectly true, that we'll be using the ACT to convince the other political parties to form a coalition at the presidential level. They will be free to select their own members of parliament, but when it comes to the presidential nomination, we would like to pull a number of political parties to rally around one opposition leader.
Bernard Membe is former Tanzanian foreign minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. The water crisis is worsening in Zimbabwe's second largest city of Bulawayo as efforts to boost the supply to residents grind to a halt due to fuel shortages. Adegondo in Bulawayo gives us more on this story.
The Bulawayo City Council is struggling to establish water kiosks to make water available in the city suburbs. So far, just 6 out of 25 planned kiosks have been completed. Each costs about US$4,500. A big part of the delay, the sharp rise in fuel prices in the country. The city says higher fuel prices are hurting operations of tanker trucks that ferry water to various points. The problem means that many areas still have little clean water. A few weeks ago, 13 people in the suburb of Luveve died due to suspected polluted water, and hundreds suffered from bouts of dysentery, vomiting, and stomach aches. For months, the city has experienced biting water shortages, and its dams are only about 26% full. It rations water delivery to preserve the little remaining water there is, so consumers often have to wait for 2 or 3 days to get water. The city council says the problems are not its fault, given the long drought and the country's economic woes. The Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association has worked with private laboratories and the National Institute of Science and Technology to run tests on water specimens acquired from Luveve residents in other areas in Bulawayo. Tembelani Dube is with the Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association, BPRA.
Most suburbs or most wards, they are not receiving Bauza water because the city council, as any other entities, is affected by shortage of fuel. As you know, that most of the garages that are selling fuel in RTGS, they are dry. So ECC, like any other service provider, is severely affected by that. But we are saying that they must plan in advance because the residents need water. Water is a human right issue.
Dube says residents are concerned about the dire state of water services and the impact on their health.
Yes, as Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association, we have engaged Bulawayo City Council regarding the situation in Luveve Ward 15, because a lot of deaths have been recorded there, and a lot of people, more than 1,700, have fallen sick because of the suspected typhoid. So we did engage the City Council through our lawyers. And right now we are having the information that we are analyzing and scrutinizing.
The city council plan to ease shortages includes setting up water kiosks using portable water tanks in areas to serve 6,099 properties. The city says it is also exploring the rehabilitation of 50 hand pumps at wells, but that is subject to the availability of funds. The main problems of the affected areas are low pressure, densely populated neighborhoods, and old infrastructure that has been weakened by frequent openings and closings during rationing. There is also a problem with social distancing at water delivery points. Dumisani Nkomo, a socio-political analyst, is frustrated by the city council's lack of accountability over the deaths of the 13 residents because of the water crisis. He has called for an independent inquest into the deaths.
For me, really, it's not about the nature crisis responses. We know what has to be done. We know that Kwai Shangani has to be completed. We know that in the very long term, we need to look at the Zambezi Water Project. But importantly, again, it's quite scandalous for the city fathers not to accept the responsibility for the tragic death of 13. The park stops with them in terms of the distribution of water. An apology is needed. But surely 13 people can die and no action is taken. Will our lives matter?
Parliamentary delegation led by Senator Chief Ngungubane Zama Nkwananzi made a fact-finding mission in Bulawayo this week to look into the 13 deaths. They met with city officials and the area manager for the Zimbabwe National Water Authority, who said that about US$1.5 million is required to complete projects to increase Bulawayo's water supplies. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
As Ghana's confirmed number of COVID-19 cases keeps rising, the government is urging citizens to take their health seriously and do regular exercise. Although social distances has made going to the gym a challenge, health experts say fancy equipment is not needed. Gyms and personal trainers have switched to online exercise classes, while a popular Ghanaian bodybuilder shows that you can exercise from anywhere during the pandemic. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Since opening her gym in 1996, Pippa Pepera has seen a growing interest in health and fitness in Ghana. Before COVID-19, at its peak, the gym would see 130 members a day. Now, many are staying away. But to help them keep fit, Pepera adjusted. She rents out equipment and encourages home workouts. The gym also offers online Azonto aerobics, a dance style that originated in Ghana.
Azonto is something that, you know, the kids can do at home, mom can do, grandma, grandpa, everybody can get involved as a family event. So we thought it would just be a fun, light way of getting people up, because we know, again, during C19, a lot of people have become couch potatoes, sitting down, much less active.
Up in a mountainous area outside the capital, bodybuilder and school teacher Samuel Kulbula is living proof that you don't need expensive equipment to keep fit. He works out in backyard gyms, where he creates and uses repurposed and improvised gym equipment like cement weights. This has earned him an international following through his social media posts. He tells followers that there is no excuse not to exercise, and the pandemic makes it even more important. Kilbilla is building his own outdoor gym in his backyard. He has also created a pandemic workout guide for his global followers to use while home.
I started getting a lot of messages, DMs and emails, people telling me to help them because their gyms have been closed, and they normally see me training at the kind of backyard gyms, and they believe I can fix something.
Before COVID-19 hit Ghana, fitness coach and mother of two, Ma Bena Entry, held boot camps for women. She has also moved her coaching online, working from her apartment in the outskirts of Accra. She's found she enjoys working from home as she can spend more time with her kids.
I'm home, so, you know, I'm able to, I think, give them a little bit more of attention and still work, even though it's not, you know, fetching as much, it's still very lucrative and it's good. And I'm looking at definitely keeping the online classes.
These Ghanaian fitness coaches have made the best out of social distancing to promote exercise online. But they also hope the motivation and encouragement from the government to stay fit will continue once a pandemic is over. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ray Key Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.